From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Dr. Denise Teacher Pope. Well, that's right. I got one right.
You got one right.
Yeah, you are the consummate teacher.
Aw, thank you.
So how did you get started in teaching? Or how were you, better yet, how were you prepared to be a teacher?
I did a very similar program to one that we have here at Stanford. So I did it at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
Shh.
Sorry, the other school.
Stanford of the East.
Stanford of the East, yes. And I did take classes both in my subject matter, which was English, and also classes on pedagogy and psychology and teaching. And then I student taught both in an urban middle school. At Harvard, they have you student teach in two different places. And then I student taught in a suburban high school. So I had sort of the traditional teacher prep experience for a year. Yeah.
So mine was a little different.
Oh, tell us about yours.
So I graduated with a philosophy degree, and I decided I'd like to give back. And it turned out I could get an emergency credential. And I thought, oh, it's a full-time job as a teacher. And so I got an emergency credential, but they sort of – something happened so that, in fact, it was only a two-week program. Two-week program in the summer, and then I was a full-time teacher in the inner city the next year.
Oh, my gosh.
With seventh grade reading and writing. And so I did well.
How did you even know what to do? What did they teach you in 2 weeks?
They taught me things like Bloom's taxonomy, which wasn't particularly actionable. You get out there and you say, well, critical thinking, high up on the pyramid.
People don't know what Bloom's taxonomy is. Can I give like a 2 second just so people will understand what that reference was? Think of a pyramid and think of different, I don't know what you would call them, analytical abilities moving up and down the pyramid.
Yeah, so like memory is at the bottom and creativity is at the top. And there's no support for this pyramid. But anyway, so I go out and I did a good job through sheer energy. You know, I probably put
fear?
On...
Fear? Was it fear?
No, I was just... Well, yeah, it's 150 kids a day, and they're at puberty. So there's some fear there.
I'm afraid already.
But I put on about 30 pounds.
What?
Yeah, it was a lot of work, and I really put all my energy into it. And so at the end of the year, I got Best Young Teacher Award.
Best Young Teacher with 2 weeks training.
Yeah, well, because they didn't know. You know, what do they know? They know I was energetic. And then I get a pink slip. Because the LA City Schools went broke.
So a pink slip, I got one too, actually. A pink slip. Hey, we have that in common,
Dan.
I got a pink slip too. So a pink slip means
you're fired.
It means we cannot guarantee that we will hire you back, is how it was explained to me, because we do not know if we can afford you. We don't know what our enrollment's going to be. A whole bunch of reasons. Right.
Yeah. Somehow I missed all those reasons. Basically, I was fired in subbing.
Oh.
And so I did what any normal person would do is I moved to Alaska and taught in an Indian village.
Yeah. That's what any normal person would do.
So I didn't get a lot of preparation. And I could have done so much better with those kids if I'd known what I was doing.
You know, it's a problem that someone who's with us today has spent a lot of time studying is teacher preparation.
Yes. What a coincidence that we were talking about it.
So we are really fortunate to have a superstar amongst us. Linda Darling Hammond is a professor emeritus at Stanford and is the director of the Learning Policy Institute, which is a think tank here in Palo Alto. She was on the transition team for President Obama back in 2008. She's a leading expert in teaching and has studied teaching all over the world. And the American Enterprise Institute in Washington says she's the most influential researcher on educational policy.
So welcome, Linda.
Welcome.
Great to be here.
So just contextualize that. So when I need an ego boost, there's this thing called Google Scholar, and it shows you how many people have cited your work. And so I'll go there and I'll look and I'll feel pretty good about it. When my ego's a little too high, do you know what I do?
You look up Linda.
I look up Linda's Google Scholar, and then I realize, oh, I'm so small.
I am nothing. I am a peon compared to the goddess. I love it.
Linda, with you, you have so much expertise in so many places. We thought we'd try something different. So what we're going to do is try a top five list, and maybe we get to one of them. We'll see. But the question to you is, what are the top five things that will transform education? And your answer to this can be, it could transform education, it should transform education, or it will transform education. So we're giving you some latitude.
Let me just start by saying I have looked at education systems around the world. And so I don't believe in the sort of what's the one thing. It really has to be a system. And I will talk about five things that I think really Excellent. Have to integrate to get a good system. Let me point out that in the 1970s, the U.S. was probably hands down the number one education country in the world in terms of attainment, in terms of achievement, by every measure that was available.
Wow.
We now, if you look on things like the program in international student assessment, the PISA tests, the international tests, we rank anywhere between around 21st and 39th, depending on the subject area. There are these little countries and some big ones that are at the top that are diverse, that are have a lot of immigration, that are had no education system in the early 60s. Singapore wasn't even a country then and had almost no education system for its Malay population or almost anyone else. Finland was one of the most low-achieving countries in Europe, et cetera. These are now at the top. So one of the questions is, like, how do countries that have built an education system that is really strong do it? And what's the difference between what they're doing and what we see in the United States right now? So number one, they take care of children. They have a child welfare system. They don't allow high rates of child poverty. In the United States, 1 out of 4 children lives in poverty. Homelessness has increased astronomically. Children with food insecurity and so on. Raggedy early childhood system for learning in the United States. In these nations, Canada is one of them also, by the way, that's near the top. Take care of children. They have food and housing, and they have early learning opportunities that are high quality.
So are these nations tending towards socialists that have,
maybe
have their
if
act
you,
together?
If you think about socialist as the collective taking care of one another, that is that you build a government capacity to do high quality support for people according to their needs. Number two, they fund schools equally. We have one of the most inequitably funded school systems in the industrialized world. Our highest spending districts in the U.S. spend 10 times more than our lowest spending districts. There's inequality across and within states. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer in the system. The more affluent students typically have more money spent on them.
Stop. No, you're going too fast. These are all meaty. So that's the problem. What will transform it?
Well, you know, California is a good example of a state that has taken that bull by its proverbial horns. And we have just recently put in place a very progressive school funding system. So now children who are in poverty, English learners, foster care children, get an allocation in addition to the base allocation per pupil, and districts that serve a lot of those students get a supplemental grant. And so there's more money directed to the students who have the greatest needs so that you can provide the wraparound services, the integrated supports, the health care, the food, et cetera, that's needed for them to then be ready to learn.
So this was an increase of money into the system. It was a reallocation.
It was both an increase through Proposition 30 and a reallocation of how we were spending money. California still spends too little. Mm-hmm. If you want to see what it looks like when you do that and you spend enough, look at Massachusetts, mm-hmm. which is our highest performing state, which performs on the same level as Finland and Singapore in the international rankings. And they did this back in the early 90s, and they spend almost twice as much as what California spends. But they also spend it equitably, with more money going to the students who have the greater needs. Look at New Jersey, which recently did a similar kind of reform. It is a majority-minority state, ranks first in the country in writing, second in reading, fourth in mathematics, closed the gap, transformed the opportunities because they spent the money the right way, which gets me to number three, four, and five.
Hold on, hold that thought. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Linda Darling-Hammond, Professor Emeritus at Stanford, Director of the Learning Policy Institute, telling us her top five list of what should be done to really transform education. And we had number one, take care of the kids. Number two, equitable financing.
And more.
And more, right? Wraparound services, et cetera. And now we're about to hear number three.
Bah, 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 bah,
bah. Drum roll. So you've got to have the right kind of learning that you're focusing on. So you need to have, and in the states that have transformed education, they focused more on what some people call meaningful learning. Some people call it deeper learning. Some people call it 21st century learning. But they have moved up Bloom's taxonomy, to refer back to our earlier point, from the rote learning that was really designed for the economy and the jobs of the past, memorize things and be able to spit them back, take it in and be able to regurgitate, to the level of analysis, synthesis, critical thinking, problem solving, creativity, which we need today. So that has to do with how you organize standards and curriculum, the kinds of assessments you use. Again, in these other countries, they have less assessment, but they have more meaningful assessment. They're focused on how kids can analyze and produce work. They have open-ended essays and problem sets, but they also have projects that are part of the assessment system where kids have to design a solution for a problem or create a science investigation and conduct it. So here we have a lot of work to do on that agenda.
We do, and I think we have to convince the parents, because I will say we just posted something on a Facebook page and we were promoting project-based learning, and a parent wrote in and said, please, no project-based learning. That is just teachers being lazy. This is exactly what she said. Teachers being lazy, and you know there's only a few students who do the work and the rest are slacking off. So there has to be some real parent education
around
that.
So you think the person who posted that was one of the people who slacked off, or the person who felt they did all the work?
It could be either one, but this parent was adamant that she was furious that we were promoting project-based learning in the school district.
Yeah, so...
So that gets me to number four.
Uh-huh.
No, wait.
But I'll come back to number three, I promise you.
Okay, go.
Number four is educator development, and we can put those two together because the kind of teaching that I'm talking about requires really well-prepared teachers who understand how to structure very, very rigorous and challenging work, how to organize groups of students if they're working cooperatively to do that work together in a productive way. That's not something you can just throw at a group of kids and say, go do this project.
Right.
Way too much of that happens in schools when teachers aren't adequately trained. But I want to go back to number three and just point out that this is what our current society and democracy and economy demand, that kids have to be able, in a world where technology knowledge is doubling every 11 months, where knowledge is increasing exponentially, where jobs are transforming, where the top in-demand jobs, the top 10 in-demand jobs of a decade from now probably haven't been invented yet. That's been the pace at which work is changing. If what you've done is memorize information and spit it back on a test, you will be utterly unprepared for that world. In fact, our kids are going to have to work with knowledge that hasn't been discovered yet and technologies that haven't been invented yet to solve big problems that we haven't been able to solve. And they need work in school that allows them to take up a problem, figure out how to find the resources that will be needed to solve that problem, work with others to design a solution, test it, evaluate it, improve it, revise it, and be able to generate their own progress in learning. That's a very different kind of teaching. It doesn't mean that facts disappear. It doesn't mean that teaching a structured curriculum disappears. But it does mean that the way you approach the curriculum has to be much more focused around that kind of inquiry than simply reading the chapter and answering the questions at the end of the book.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Dr. Linda Darling-Hammond, Professor Emeritus at Stanford, Director of the Learning Policy Institute, about how to really transform schools. And we've hit quite a few different pieces.
This is also your belief, Denise, that curriculum and instruction is the key.
This is my belief, too. I am a Linda disciple. So, yes, you're not going to hear. I think that what goes on in the classroom and the sort of sage on the stage lecture, take notes and spit it back, leaves people woefully unprepared. So, yes, I'm in agreement.
So let's say I'm a cynic.
Let's say you're a cynic. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's going to be a rough one.
But, so Common Core comes out and I've heard complaints about math that what it's done is, rather than helping students get understanding, it's just made the procedures more complex. So making things harder makes it seem as though you're understanding more deeply.
You can do deeper learning badly. You can do anything badly.
So I'm trying to decide. So I've done lots of studies about how do you prepare people so that they can continue learning the next thing. And I've often wondered, how would I do the study to show that a complete curriculum is leading to greater lifelong success in a fast-changing future? Like, is there a way to do this? I go follow them out. I get one state that does sort of project-based learning and one state that does rote. Then I follow these kids out, 15 years, and I ask them, are you satisfied? Are you changing quickly? Like, is there a way to know, or is this...
Linda's looking at you because you and your colleagues at Vanderbilt and then here at Stanford have done a lot of the studies.
It's a little rhetorical.
So let me just say I am a disciple of both Denise and Dan because this kind of learning is what you've been documenting for a long time. That, going back, I'm thinking of the Jasper project at Vanderbilt.
Video disc problem solving. You get this long narrative, and then you'd have to figure out how to solve the problem.
Yeah, and the studies that came from that and many other similar projects where kids have to problem solve. It's not as though direct instruction completely disappears. There's information that's provided. Yeah. They can access it. Teachers can guide it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, in that and many, many other studies of designed project-based learning, have found that kids do as well as others on the traditional multiple choice tests and do significantly better on tasks that require them to use those strategies for problem solving and that ask them to transfer their knowledge from the first instance to a new situation. And it's that transfer of knowledge that is the magic sauce. Mm-hmm. That's what we need. I mean, nobody's going to go to school for the rest of their life and sit there each day and take a multiple choice test and collect a paycheck and go home. They have to go out and do other things that require them to transfer their knowledge. And that learning science foundation has been built that allows us to know a number of the things that are necessary to do in order to allow for that transfer of learning. The problem is we don't always train teachers back to educator development so that they get access to that knowledge.
Yeah.
And that is what has to happen for project-based learning or any kind of inquiry learning or deeper learning to be successful in the classroom and beyond the classroom when kids get out in the world.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Linda Darling-Hammond talking about really how to transform education, her top five list, next on SiriusXM Insight 121. We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Dr. Linda Darling-Hammond, who is a leading expert in teaching and schools and system reform.
Everything.
Pretty much everything. Yeah. We are excited to hear her pearls of wisdom.
So, Linda, you said teachers need to know that knowledge, and I wasn't quite sure. What is the that? that they need to know to be effective?
There's a pretty wide and deep basket of knowledge that teachers need to have. I mean, they need to understand how people learn and how people learn differently. That is, not everyone learns exactly in the same way. So there's a range of learning and learning differences. They need to know how people develop in social and emotional and academic and moral and physical ways. And all those areas of child development interact with each other. They need to understand the relationship, for example, between emotion and learning. You only really learn when you are excited, interested. There's a set of positive emotions. It might just be that you like your teachers. If you have negative emotions, if you're fearful, if you think somebody is going to criticize you or stereotype you, you know, you're going to learn less. So all of that has to be understood by teachers. They also need to know about curriculum and how to build a curriculum that gets kids from wherever they are to the curriculum goals we have for them. They need to understand assessment, how not only to give a test and give a grade, which is how a lot of people have thought about assessment, but also how to assess how kids are learning and then reshape the teaching to help them learn more or help them revise their own work so that they can improve their practice. They need to understand many, many dimensions about issues of equity in schools. We have a very inequitable school system in the way it's structured. Quite often, we can replicate a lot of inequality by treating kids differently and some getting more benefits than others. So teachers in this day and age need to build a democratic kind of environment and classroom to raise up a generation of young people who are ready to contribute to society. So the basket of learning, I could go on this for some time, but
you're 2 weeks.
Well, that's what I think. So it has always seemed to me that teacher education, the idea that you can accomplish this in a year, it just can't be true. It's too much to learn and to know. And yet people sort of say, why do we need teacher education? Is there any chance we could extend teacher education to pre-service to 2 years, or is the opportunity cost too high? It's just not, there's not the political will to do it. It's asking people to commit to something for a long time before they've ever tried it.
If you were becoming a primary school teacher in Finland, which is hard to do, only 1 out of 10 people get admitted, you would be undertaking 3 years of undergraduate and 2 years of graduate study and graduating with a master's degree. And that would be true for every single teacher in Finland. Education would be free, and you would be earning a stipend while you're in training.
So there's not a lot of teacher attrition?
There's not a lot of teacher attrition. And the same is true in Singapore, in Canada, in Australia. Teachers typically do either a four-year undergraduate, but more typically now a five-year course of study, which includes a graduate year. And they do it at very little cost to themselves for tuition and with a lot of supports to enable them. And these countries understand that teaching is the profession on which all other professions depend. If you don't do it well, everything else suffers. And so they make an investment in teachers. We have done that in the United States from time to time, but it has been a very long struggle over more than a century to get teaching supported as a profession and treated as a profession. So there are some spectacular teacher education programs in the United States. One of them happens to be at Stanford. People come from all over the world, including Singapore and Japan and Brazil and many other places, to learn how Stanford's teacher education program does what it does in that one graduate year, which everyone would like to make two. So it's not that there isn't good teacher education here, but you know, as the dean, you have to go out and raise money all the time for scholarships for those students, because it would be unaffordable to them if you didn't do that. So I'm just putting in a plug for you to keep doing it. And those young people come out and they say, I get the calls, and my colleagues have gotten the calls for years. I knew what I needed to know when I entered teaching. Now, did they know everything they needed to know to continue to teach? Well, what they knew was enough of the foundation of how children learn and develop and how to build curriculum and so on, and they've had a very rigorous program to learn it, and they knew how to continue to learn. Yeah. They knew how to collaborate with their colleagues, how to reach out for resources, how to find additional curriculum materials, where to go to shore up the next issue and the next problem that they would confront, because teaching requires daily learning on the part of teachers throughout their entire careers. It's what makes it so exciting.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Linda Darling Hammond about the importance of teaching and teacher education. And she's given us a top five list. I believe we've heard one through four.
It's time for five.
Time for number five.
Well, once we've got children who've been well taken care of and schools that are equitably funded and a curriculum and assessment system that focuses on meaningful, useful learning and well-educated teachers and leaders for those schools, we need to redesign the schools themselves because we still have inherited these factory model designs that were created in the early 1900s. Literally, they were modeled on the factory so that kids go from class to class, like on the assembly line, and somebody stamps them with a lesson as they go by in the high school, 45 minutes here, boing, now you're off to the next 45 minutes.
So sad. Yeah.
And it's not working for us.
So what does redesign mean? Does it mean architecture?
It can mean architecture. It can mean that you are building schools in which there's much more room for collaboration, because that is the modus of work in the future and the mode of much work in schools now. In fact, in Singapore, where I've spent a bunch of time in the one teacher education program that exists, the National Institute of Education, they have classrooms of the future. They've built the architecture so that there are groupings and teachers learn in these settings so that they can create these settings in their classrooms. They learn in groupings. They have little cones where groups can work in, you know, sheltered
cones,
silence.
Like
They've got whiteboards around, et cetera.
But
so that's part of it. But it's only
redesign
part of it.
Means what? Just in general, what is school redesign?
With 1 minute to go.
Yeah, it means that we rethink the way that we organize time, people, and supports for learning. So, for example, in high schools, students might be taught by a team of teachers who actually stays with them for an additional year. They might have an advisor who stays with a group of students for all 4 years so that they are not able to fall through the cracks, so that they are personally known and personally supported. And it may mean that they have these opportunities to go out into the community and do work that is meaningful as part of internships and externships, as well as working in classrooms with technologies as well as with books.
A whole lot of changes have to happen, Dan.
So a lot of experimentation is going on. It would be nice to have better systems in place to find out which things are working, as opposed to requiring some scholar from a university to go out and do research. You'd sort of like these systems to just be able to bring that information so you could find out what's working, continual improvement. That strikes me as one of the things that's going to change. Go ahead.
I get to thank Linda for coming. Thank you for your top five list. Thank you, listeners, for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes, and on SoundCloud.